How much time did you put in? How many people did you speak to when you made the decision to quit? And from the information I have, I don't know if you want to share or not, you turned down a very, very large payday when you quit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to share.
When I say a payday, I mean that year alone.
Well, look, I mean, it was even crazier than the Wall Street or the New York Times thing made it sound because, you know, part of whatever deal was that I had, you know, I got offered that or I got given that $3.6 million bonus. But then I had to, if I would left for any reason that year, I had to forfeit half of it. And so, you know, I had my sort of choice was between I argued for $8 million, just to like step back and explain that, like not even explain it, but like, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things about sort of pay on Wall Street that's sort of crazy to me is that, and I mean crazy in the way of like I'm crazy about it, was that like, well, and also that it sort of makes sense at the same time was like, you know, when you're in it, there's, it's all about relative value. So I got paid $3.6 million, but I thought given how much money I had earned for the firm and what sort of percent payouts should be that that I deserved $8 million. And so, but at the same time, I sort of knew that it was crazy that a 30, you know, whatever I was, 30-year-old kid was getting paid that sort of much money. But, you know, I went in and I argued for $8 million, both because I thought I deserved it, but also the truth is because I sort of knew I was going to leave. And, you know, it was way scary at the time. And, you know, I had like $2 million in the bank and, you know, it would have been a lot easier to leave with $4 million in the bank, you know. But, you know, that they sort of said, they didn't commit to any number, but they said, look, we will raise your thing if you, you know, agree to stay for several more years. I said I wasn't willing to do that, and then that was it.
You stood to make like $10 million following you?
I mean, who knows? I mean, one of the things, you know, some of the people above me actually left right then too. So it was all of a sudden there was like this massive vacuum at the top. And the guy above me, I don't actually know what he got paid, but I mean, it was rumored 20 to 50. So I'm not saying I would have gotten that, but, you know, I was right at that point of being a super senior trader at a major hedge fund where, you know, I mean, anything is possible. I could have been, you know, $3 million the next year. It could have been five. It could have been 10. It could have been 20.
How long was the process from when you decided, hey, I think I'm gonna quit this to the actual execution?
You know, I mean, when I started dating my wife and my now wife, it was about 5 months before I left, and I was talking about it pretty seriously, but I didn't know. And then there was a period of about 3 months when I really like started to face the reality of that decision. And like, you know, look, it's, you know, some of these, you know, I said one day when during like Christmas, my brother came over and said, you know, and I was like, just clearly upset. And he was like, what are you upset about? And I'm like, I'm just so scared about what's going to happen when I leave. And I really felt like that. Like, I just didn't know. It felt like I was going to, like, step off the edge of the world, you know, and I wasn't going to have a job. I didn't have any idea about everything that came later, about a nonprofit or about a book or about anything like that. Like, I had no idea what was going to happen, and I was honestly terrified of it. And so I really struggled for about 3 months. I was really, like, in my head about it. And also, frankly, that last, like, bargaining for $8 million was really part of that because, you know, I wish I had sort of enough sort of confidence or faith in myself or the world or whatever in like what I sort of would end up sort of becoming and believing to have like gone in and sort of been really nice to those guys and said, you know, thank you for the opportunity. But, you know, I think this is no longer a fit for me. I'm going to leave. But instead I like argued for a bigger bonus because the thought of just leaving by myself without getting more money was frankly terrifying.
Switching gears, what I'm very curious about, I can't remember which interview it was, and the short version is that you've made some enemies with your article. How does that argument go? And what is the other side's argument? Sorry. How does that conversation go? And what is their case?
I think there's a couple cases like, you know, and I don't want to like disrespect anybody's sort of belief system. So, you know, I just sort of believe that they're entitled to that. I do think that, like, well, here, let me put it to you. I'll tell you a couple different things. But one is, you know, even some of my closest friends, like, you know, I have like three or four super close friends on Wall Street I knew would have my back and do have my back, and they have done so. And I've been incredibly grateful for that. And then I have this, you know, network of like 20 people that was probably like considered like close friends, or relatively close friends, but that I didn't know how that was going to go. And for some of them, it's, you know, actually some of them were pretty similar. So one, you know, at the first sort of wave of reaction was really positive. Wow, Sam's got this big piece on the front page of the New York Times Sunday Review. It's a huge deal. Everybody's talking about it. I'm friends with him. I'm really excited. But then, like, about a week into it, I started getting calls, and, you know, clearly these guys had been getting shit from people that they knew, and they were sort of like, well, you're not saying that I'm a terrible person, right? I mean, it's like the people, you know, on Wall Street, and they would name certain people, and they'd be like, those guys are, like, really bad people, but you're not talking about me, right? And what I would say to them is sort of what I believe, which is that I don't believe that anybody's a bad person. And I don't believe that, I believe that everybody's, like, incredibly complex and unique, and I also believe that the system I was a part of is a system that encourages sort of arrogance and narcissism, and it's a difficult system. And if, you know, you, somebody was to ask one man's opinion and that man was me, I'd say I'm in favor of some changes of that. And that's it. And I think that it's, so I don't think it's about good people or bad people. I don't think it's about demonizing people. But one of the things that I came to realize was that even though I was, you know, kind of following the rules and doing legal stuff and, you know, not being gaudy or ostentatious or anything like that, I sort of came to see in myself that this whole sort of life I was living of just trying to accumulate more and more money for myself was sort of not how I wanted to spend my life. And that's what I'm saying. That said, like, I also sort of think about it, and so that's what I'm saying, which is, like, I believe that my article was, like, not only an article about my own personal story and what I went through, and, you know, without sort of fingers pointed at other people except for myself, although at the end I did say some things about the culture, which I absolutely stand by, because, you know, like anything, like, the sort of point of my piece was, like, this is what I went through, this is how I came to see it, and because of this experience, this is how I see this culture, and that's my opinion. But I also think about, like, you know, I don't know if you have any experience with addicts or alcoholics, but if you ever tell an addict that they have a problem, they're going to get pissed at you. That's just how they react, right? And you know, the nature of being addicted to something is that you are constantly telling yourself you don't have a problem until the day that you finally admit that you have a problem, because on that day, you have to face the reality of it. And so I will say that some of the reaction I got from Wall Street has been that I believe that there's a similarity to that. So, you know, it's almost like, you know, imagine a guy, you know, a kind of bright young guy walks into a dark bar in the middle of the day, and there's a bunch of alcoholics sitting around a bar, and he says, hey guys, look, I was just like you, but then I did this and this and this, and this is how it feels now, and it's pretty dope. You know? And I think there was a lot of reactions that were similar to how those guys would have reacted. But then there's been a lot of, like, you know, really, really interesting things coming out. First of all, I've got a ton of emails from people on Wall Street. And if I was going to, like, put it as on a percentage basis, like, way lower percentage of emails from people at the higher end of Wall Street, although I've gotten a couple, but a ton of emails from people in the, you know, first, second, third, fourth, fifth years who are sort of grappling with this stuff in a way that I really was. And, you know, I don't know what you believe or whatever, but, you know, maybe it's harder to sort of, maybe it seems more threatening to people that are, like, you know, 15, 20 years, 30 years into Wall Street, what I was saying, than people at the lower end who are just kind of starting to grapple with this culture. And then in addition to that, the even better part of it is first of all, there have been several people that have reached out that want to start these support groups. And honestly, if I was living in New York, they would be running right now. And I'm trying to figure out how to do it, whether we do it on Skype, can that even work? But there's definitely people that sort of identified with my story in a way that said, you know, I do actually feel trapped and empty, and I want something different from my life, and I'm having trouble leaving because I'm scared of losing the lifestyle or, you know, the position or whatever it is, And so I don't by any means think that I'm going to fix these people, but I would think it would be great to get other people that are in the same sort of boat together and talk about it. The second thing is that that 25% fund that I threw out at the end of the piece has gotten some traction in a way that is small and legitimate. So one guy for sure, and then three other people who have sort of verbally committed to doing it, although I just don't say that they're in just because I'm not 100% sure of the kind of strength of their conviction about it. Mm-hmm. But I am starting to, like, take steps to say, okay, if we do have five guys into this, then that's something, and that's meaningful, and we can create this fund. And, you know, the sort of hard part, I think, is, like, sort of defining the terms of the fund to say, okay, and my best thought now is, you know, you call it the 25% fund. People put 25% of their bonuses into it. It goes into a collective pool, and then we all sort of get together on a regular basis, and much like a hedge fund picking trade ideas, sort of have kind of the best and brightest social entrepreneurs come in and pitch us on, you know, the best sort of, you know, social innovations or...
Have you read or watched much Chamath Palihapitiya stuff?
No, I don't know who that is.
He was the head of growth at Facebook. You should watch some of his Launch and Disrupt interviews with Jason Calacanis. You'll enjoy what he's saying. He left Facebook. There were 700 million users. He made money on a few other things along the way. He was the head of growth at for AIM, and he was at Winamp in like 2001.
I remember. That's funny.
He was a trader for a year. What did he say? He said, Wall Street guys are smart enough to be greedy, but not smart enough. They're smart enough to want to make money, but not smart enough to do anything important. So he left Wall Street. He was the head of growth, the CMO, chief marketing officer at Facebook. Left, and he's built a venture capital fund. They launched their first fund with $250 million. They raised a second one. They have no investment thesis. It's just a bunch of the wealthiest guys in the valley. And the entire program is they only invest in things that they believe will change the world positively.
Wow.
And so far, in unrealized gains, they've crushed. I don't know what the realized gains look like, according to him, through the roof. But I'm sure you'll dig a lot of his stuff.
Well, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. And so does it sound like that's what you guys are sort of looking at doing?
Well, a little bit different, because I think mine is, or ours is going to be a little bit more charitable, meaning that, like, I think that, you know, there are things that we'll have to think through in terms of, you know, do we have it a sort of Robin Hood? Sorry, one sec. Do we have it a sort of Robin Hood fund where we get money in every year and then give it all away that year and just start from zero again, which is, I think, an attractive model and a very difficult one? Or is it one where we do an endowment style, and maybe, you know, do some sort of impact investing, much like your guys or those Facebook guys seem like they're doing an awesome version of that. But then if we did it, we would, I think, give, you know, set up a foundation, an endowment structure so that we're giving away a prescribed amount each year. And because, I mean, I'll tell you from me personally, the idea for this, I'll tell you what the idea is like, you know, it's all about sort of a definition of money. So when I was, you know, when I was on Wall Street, and even still today, you know, I'll pull up my Fidelity account and I'll look at these sort of digits in the ether, and I'll breathe a sigh of relief and say, oh God, phew, if I still have money, you know. And that's like, and that's in some sense, in a very sort of small sense, that's what I was doing all those years. Was trying to build up those numbers in that Fidelity account so I could breathe a big sigh of relief. And one of the things that I've learned for my own self personally, and also through my work with grocery ships, is that there is there needs to be a translation between people like myself who sort of view money like that to the sort of folks at the low end who I believe can use that money in a real way and need it. And, you know, my Fidelity account goes up 20, 30 grand a day or down 20 or 30 grand a day, and I don't sleep at night or I don't worry about it. But that 30 grand would have a real impact on some folks. And and also kind of helping those folks would have a real impact on me. And so that's the whole idea behind this 25% fund, is to say, okay, you know, I understand that. I actually think that charity where you just write a check and send it to an organization is sucks because you don't feel it. But there's a lot of people making a lot of money who want to be part of something bigger, who, you know, that's the thing, is people like demonize Wall Street guys and they say they're either one thing or they're not. But they're complex individuals who no doubt have a yearning for connection and purpose in the way that I believe is sort of innate to human beings. No doubt also it's harder for that. They might have a little bit more of the need to accumulate money than your average guy, although that's a pretty pervasive thing too. I mean, one of the great things I have found about my article, or the response I got to it, was that so much came back in the form of, you know, people that say, so many letters started the same way. I don't make near as much as what you did, but I feel the same way. I make $100,000 a year, but I don't know what's, I never feel like I have enough. I make this. Or a lot of guys on Wall Street, I'm an equity trader at this shop. I'm nowhere near the numbers that you're making, but I still feel the same way. And so I do think it like cuts across all swaths. And so the idea with this fund would be like, okay, not only do we acknowledge, you know, for me personally, what it feels like acknowledging is all the sort of gifts and privileges that I got in my life, which even though, as you point out, I didn't come from a lot of money, I didn't come from a great educational background, but my parents both went to decent colleges and they read a lot, and I'm white and born in America and a male. And all those things gave me huge advantages. And by the way, the fact that I sort of was born smart, which is definitely a talent, but is also something that was given to me that I didn't do to deserve. At least that's how I feel about it. And so all that is to say, there's a lot of people that didn't have those advantages. And so the idea behind the 25% fund is to say, okay, let's take, you know, a certain percentage of, if you're making more money than you need at any given time, let's not only take some of that money, but let's also, you know, create this structure or group where, you know, you belong to something and, you know, you're using your resources, both your money and your mind and your talents and analysis, and sort of looking at all these potential investments, but investments not in the way of, you know, here's going to be your return on capital, but investments in the way of, here's $8,000. It's going to cost $8,000 to take this kid from a homeless kid on the street to one who graduates college next year. You know, and you're never going to see that $8,000 yet. And you know what? That's still the best investment you ever made.
Now that you've gone through all this, what did you come to define as enough for you, and how did you define it?
Boy, man, that, first of all, that's a great question, and my second answer is, I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you right now that I have, you know, between my wife and I, about $2 million, and right now that feels like enough. I also know that earlier this year it dipped lower, so it was like at 1.6, and I still felt like it was enough. But I'm definitely, like, I wrote about this idea of wealth addiction, and dude, I believe it 100%. Like, you know, I would literally call, as you know now, I have an identical twin brother, and he and I are closer than anybody in the world, and I would call him, and he's, you know, he got 2 degrees from Harvard and is now doing poverty law in South LA, and he earns $40,000 a year, and he has $200,000 in debt, and I would call him, and I would say, oh my God, dude, I'm so freaked out. I've only got 1.6 million. The market crashed today and blah, blah, blah. And he would literally listen to me. And like, first of all, that is a great story about what an asshole I can be sometimes. And also a great story about what a great guy he is. But that's what I mean, which is that, you know, if you'd asked me years ago if having $2 million in the bank was enough, I would have said, no way. I want to make enough so that I don't have to worry about money ever again. And $2 million to me didn't seem like that. Today it does. And I think that I could get even lower and feel like I had enough. But I also, you know, this thing is inside me. And so I would get scared, honestly, if I got to 700 grand or 500 grand, I would get scared. But I'll also say, I really, like, one of the things that I've been working on in this sort of process is, like, you know, George, just sort of like playing it out until the end. Do you know what I mean? And I guess what I mean is that, like, you know, sometimes I get scared about money, right? But I also know that, as I mentioned before, I'm not only a white male born in America, but now also an Ivy League graduate, and one also who has the sort of clear and proven ability to make money. And so even in the worst case scenario, absolute worst case, I would not only be all right, but be more all right than 99% of the rest of the world. So I I'm an imperfect human being by a long shot, and I have to constantly talk to myself out of the sort of distortion that I believe that I have sort of learned to see the world in.
Okay, do you think, do you think the wealth addiction culture we have pertains only to American society? Do you think other countries have this same problem, specifically thinking of the countries with the low gaps between the rich and poor, Sweden, Denmark, etc.?
I don't know too much about those countries. So I watched a documentary once about Denmark that had to do with like communal housing. And
yeah, I saw that too. That was on Netflix, right? The families. Yeah.
And I thought that was cool. And I thought that was like respectable. So from that one sliver, I think that they probably have less of a problem than we do about this. But I also think that, what I think that question gets at is like, yeah, I think that this is not only I think it's probably an American-led thing, but I think it's like a very Western, massively open issue. And it's not just Wall Street, it's Silicon Valley, it's Hollywood, I think the question you asked earlier about like, the lower swaths of people that aren't making millions of dollars on Wall Street. Like, I believe that we have a culture that doesn't value balance, that values more and the accumulation of wealth and power above all without there being enough. I think that sort of our culture's definition of enough is $1 billion. And I think about like the Warren Buffett, Bill Gates thing as like the giving pledge is like, it all makes sense to us because those guys who have $1 billion, they have enough. So they could give 50%. But one of the things about my article was like, oh, maybe a guy who has way less than that. And it's definitely sort of jarring to not only people on Wall Street and not only people in America, but like across the board, people's belief system.
Let's see. Do you still hang out with a bunch of people that are wealth addicts? I know there's this idea that you're a product of the people you hang out with the most. Do you have to change friends, associates in order to break the addiction?
Yes and no. So Michael, I'm still incredibly close with. I have two of my best friends out in LA are, guys that work on Wall Street that make a significant amount of money. They're my best friends, for sure. And we hang out a lot. Several of them are on the board of grocery ships. That said, I definitely talk to Wall Street people less and less. And there's a reason for that, which is that like, I sort of have come to see that there's a belief system on Wall Street that is sort of hard to get out of. Like I believe that we are more than we think a product of the systems that we are a part of. And I notice that when I talk to people on Wall Street, there's sort of a system of belief that sort of grates against my own right now. And so I still love my friends, but I can also spend, actually you were in Charleston, a couple of years after I left Wall Street, I went down to Charleston and for my friend Craig's wedding and stayed there for 5 days, and it was 4 days too long. It was like around a system of belief that was sort of harder to deal with when I was outside of it.
Okay, next question. What made you choose grocery ships to start? Was there a particular event that drew you into that? That injustice. So guys, just so everyone's clear, the site is groceryships.com, ships with an S at the end, .com, and then there's a link on there, which I'll be posting here, that you guys can make donations. Okay, yeah, so now you can, start discussing grocery ships.
Yeah, so sure. So there's two things. One is, as I mentioned to you guys earlier, I grew up struggling with my own weight. One of the things I hope sort of was my message in that article was that I do believe that addictions are fungible, and my belief is that, addictions are sort of how I was the ways that I used to numb a sort of spiritual pain inside. And for me, that was a lot of pain from my childhood. So the first way I learned to numb that was by eating a lot. And so I sort of, as I mentioned earlier, grew up a heavy kid and sort of dealt with the emotional pain of being a heavy kid in America, which meant getting picked on and made fun of and all that stuff. And that was really painful. So I had that. I've always had that in the back of my mind. And now I'm, you know, 34 and I've gotten much better with food over the years. And I'm very, you know, at a very healthy weight and feel good about that. But it's still something that I struggle with, you know, regularly. Like I don't have the sort of most easy relationship with food. It's something I have to work on. So that's the background. And then my wife and I saw this movie called A Place at the Table, which is a documentary about hunger in America. And first of all, you know, the idea that there were kids that didn't know what they were going to eat. I mean, some of the things I learned not only in that movie, but later, but like, you know, kids will, you know, even you'll come and you'll offer a kid, you know, food at lunch because you feel like he doesn't have enough. And he'll say no, and he'll say no because he hasn't eaten for 2 days, and he knows that if he eats, he's going to feel hungry, and he doesn't know where his next meal is going to come from. And right now, without eating, he doesn't feel hungry. And so there was stuff like that where I just saw, like, honestly, I had a tougher childhood, or at least it felt tough to me, and the thought that there were kids that were sort of dealing with their own childhoods and in a way that where they didn't know where their next meal was coming from was like crushing to me. But even more crushing was that in America, hunger looks different than Ethiopia, because in America, you don't have one meal and then your next meal is KFC. And so there's a huge correlation between poverty and obesity and hunger and obesity. And that goes for kids a lot too. And so the idea of just like the difficulty that these kids were faced with, and my wife and I were watching this while we were sitting in our, you know, home in Westwood and this beautifully manicured lawns and, you know, beautiful kind of suburban home, and knowing that 5 miles away there were kids that were not only hungry but also were obese was just sort of broke my heart. And so I just sort of faced with that question that everybody starts doing is like, well, what do you do about this? And I had no idea. And then a friend of mine came over and I started talking to him about what I was feeling. And he said, you know, why don't you just buy a family groceries, you know, find a hungry family and buy them groceries. But of course, that's not so easy to do, because what do? Just call around and ask if anybody's hungry. And then there's a lot of issues with that. And, you know, and so I started the process of like thinking through an idea about, okay, what if we did buy a family groceries? Well, what does that do? And, you know, and I had had this experience once. I don't know if you know anything like it, but I remember once.
Timeline? When was this date-wise?
This was early 2013, so it was 3 years after I left.
This is only a year ago, like exactly a year ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but when this was happening, it was probably February 2013, so a year ago, yeah. And I... Yeah, and so I started, like, I had this experience in India where, you know, this was right after I left Wall Street, and I was sort of traveling through India and seeing this, like, unbelievable poverty and kids that were out there begging on the streets, and I had this, like, you know, and I had $1 million in the bank, and it was just like, God, this is so crazy. And so for whatever reason, you know, I got this, you know, naive sort of inspiration to like, well, you know what, I have enough money that any kid that comes up to me on Chowpatty Beach, I'm going to buy him an ice cream tonight. I'm not going to say no, because in India, everybody's always asking me for money, and I say no, always, you know. And so I started to do that one night, and literally cut to 3 hours later, and I'm like running away across the street with like a horde of like 20 kids chasing me. And the sort of moral I took away from that story is like, you know, just giving money to hungry people, I do think is good, but it doesn't sort of change things. And it's so easy to just start giving money away into a vacuum. And so I started to think about that with these families and said, okay, well, I want to buy them groceries. And it's important to me that they have healthy food even for 6 months. And, you know, is there something that we can do to kind of arrest this sort of systemic problem on an individual level? And so what we came up with is this idea of grocery ships, which is scholarships for groceries. So how it works is families apply for our program. So we have different partnerships. So we go into, you know, for example, our first pilot program is with LA's Promise. and that starts actually on Wednesday. And so what that looks like is they have these facilities where they're a nonprofit embedded in South LA, which is a really poor area in LA. And they and so we go in and we give information sessions where we talk about our program, and then families apply. And so this time we were way oversubscribed on applications, and so we had to do interviews. So we interviewed all these families and ultimately awarded 10 families groceryships. That's our first class. And what they get during the 6-month program is that, first of all, they get financial support. So each week, each family gets about $100 a week that they can only spend on the healthiest foods, you know, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, just whole plant foods. And the way we sort of know that they're going to buy that is that each week we give them a gift card to the local Food for Less, and the next week they have to bring back their receipts and that show that they only got the food that's sort of the healthiest foods, and then they can get the next week's. And then each week there is a 2-hour class, and the 2-hour class, the first half is focused on sort of the practical skills necessary to navigate a difficult food environment. So, you know, nutrition education, which a lot of people don't have, and cooking skills, how to cook in a healthy manner and how to prepare food, and shopping skills, so how to navigate a grocery store and how to read labels and understand what is, you know, hoaxy and what's not. But then the second half of the program is, or each weekly meeting, which I think is the most important, is the sort of emotional psychological side, which is, for lack of a better word, a support group. And I really think that's important because, you know, I wrote this op-ed that got published in the OC Register about the correlation between specifically financial stress and obesity, which has been, like, proven in these really interesting studies. But, you know, if you think about what it's like to be a sort of a low-income person, well, first of all, take a step back and say what it's like to be a person in America, which is pretty much what it's like to struggle with food, meaning that 70% of Americans are overweight or obese. And even the people who are not oftentimes struggle with their relationships with food. And it's doubly bad in low-income areas. And one of the reasons that it is because the life of a low-income family is just more stressful. There's more worry about money. There's more chance of unemployment. Sometimes there's 2 or 3 jobs. There's less time at home. Oftentimes it's one parent. I mean, that's true across the board, but even more in low-income areas. And so this idea that we're talking about, you know, with this grocery ships program is this simple idea, but that opens a Pandora's box. And what I mean by that is the simple idea is the whole program is about increasing the amounts of, you know, fruits and vegetables and whole foods into their diet. That's the sort of simplest metric of success. Like, you know, hopefully these families start with like 5% as part of their diet, and then by the end of it, they're at 30%, and their health will show improvement on that. But, you know, the other side of it is as you improve the health of your diet, then all of a sudden you start losing weight and you stop having the ability to go to McDonald's at the end of a day. And all these things that people have kind of used to numb feelings and numb the stress in their lives gets taken away. And so that's what the support group is for. And so it's effectively families sharing with each other about the challenges and stresses of, you know, their challenges with food. And I'll be teaching that group with this woman named Angela, who's this incredible Latina woman who, you know, grew up in communities like this. She herself has lost 100 pounds. And we will, you know, it's really important to me that it's clear that we are not sort of like experts coming in to sort of fix these people or teach them appropriate ways to eat. But we're effectively saying, look, we're providing education and support, but we also suffer from the same thing, you know, in different ways, given that I do live in Westwood and you live in South LA, but also in similar ways where I know what it's like to struggle with food and I know what it's like to sort of be teased about weight and, you know, feel like I'm, you know, too heavy and all those things. And so that's pretty much the program.
How did the event go last night at the house? Well, you guys were raising money last night as well, correct?
You know, actually less so. We were more like trying to community build last night. So we did raise some money, but mostly, you know, what we wanted to do was sort of like harness all the sort of attention that we'd been getting. I mean, the thing about all this press has been, you know, really this like, you know, outpouring of support. There's been a ton of donations coming in, but even more like, you know, people volunteering and people wanting to be involved. And so we're sort of like, you know, in this really interesting organizational moment where we're figuring out, you know, not only what we need to do on a programmatic level to take this to the next level, but also, like, you know, where we sort of fit in this whole movement. And there's clearly, like, a community of people that are really interested in, you know, us, because we are kind of doing this work in this world that a lot of people have a stake in. A lot of people feel this, you know, upsetness about inequality, but also this upsetness at the obesity epidemic, and also this sort of, like, feeling of powerlessness about, like, what to do with all this stuff. Like, you know, so many people that are overweight want to do something about it, but they don't know what. And I'm not saying that we're going to fix all those people. I'm just saying that we are providing a program and a structure that helps people who have very limited resources, you know, gives them a structure with which they can improve their lives, or through which they can improve their own lives. And some of the idea behind it really was, like, in LA, there are so many sort of wonderful things popping up on the sort of healthy eating stage, like, you know, restaurant, Whole Foods, obviously, and, you know, Real Food Daily and Cafe Gratitude. And there's clearly this movement about, like, wellness and health kind of coming in the world. But that's definitely mostly in the white upper class world. And there's no Cafe Gratitude in South LA and no Whole Foods in Compton. And, you know, effectively what we're saying is, like, look, like, you know, I know the realities of money are very real. At the same time, you know, these families in South LA, I just want to be a voice saying, like, your health value matters to us as much as the guy in Brentwood. And, you know, we've set up a program to sort of hopefully make it a little bit easier for you to get your family healthy, if that's what you're sort of motivated to do.
Do you have any last plugs you want to give? It's again, it's groceryships with an S at the end.com. And there's a donate button right there on the front on the homepage, correct? Like, near the upper right side.
Yeah. Well, look, why don't I tell you, you know, we did these interviews with these women, and there's one woman in my mind who sort of sticks out, and I keep thinking about her. So she's this, like, beautiful African-American woman, probably like 50 years old, just this huge smile on her face. And she came into this interview, and one of the things we noticed about her application is that she had zero children, and most people have children. In fact, everybody has children, and that's sort of the point of the program, is really to get to the children through the parents. And she had no children, and we said, what's up? And she said, you know, actually, I live in a house, and there's five children, but none of them are mine. I'm the only adult there. And we said, well, you know, whose kids are these? And she said, oh, they're my brothers and sisters are their parents, but they're all addicted to drugs and crack, and they're out on the streets. And so their kids live with me. And she talked about how every holiday, every Thanksgiving and Christmas, the parents are allowed in to come to the house, and she cooks them dinner, and they're allowed to shower, and they see their kids. And their kids are sort of, like, scared every year. And they're like, you know, are those my parents? You know, and then after dinner, they are asked to leave, because they're, you know, out on the street and they're addicts. And so she says these kids always come up to her right after and say, you know, what am I going to turn out like my dad? And she says, you know, my job is to say, no, you're going to turn out like me. And I only say that, I don't, you know, we're going to teach this woman a lot about food, and we're going to give her a safe, supportive environment to, you know, figure out what she needs to figure out for these next 6 months on some level. But I do think that's an important story, only to say, like, first of all, that's what's at stake, right? Which is these five kids who have no parents, and this is their one sort of guardian who's trying to teach them a better life. And two, also, it's important to me because that's what that woman's dealing with. And my problems, for me personally, seem so inconsequential compared to what she's dealing with. And also, it really has implications in terms of, like, what our metrics of success are, because, you know, it would be really easy, and frankly, you guys, you know, maybe funders of ours, and I'll talk to you about how much, you know, improvement we hope to see in BMI and blood pressure. And I do think that stuff is important, and we need to have a program that shows effectiveness. And at the same time, we're going to provide that woman really healthy food for 6 months for those kids whose family or whose parents are out on the street. And to me, that's a good in and of itself, and that's success enough, as far as I'm concerned.
I can't imagine too many people on the call won't make a donation after that story, that's for sure. Life should be easy. I've got a guy sitting in the car right next to me. We've been on the call with you the whole time. outside of Tom's Tiki Bar. I don't even know how we ended up in Palm Beach. We're both just totally captivated sitting there in the bar. Everything's really tuned out. Let me see your phone. Let me see if there's any last questions. If you want, you can just give like 20 second answers, and there's three last ones, so then I'll let you go. You indicate others, the financial scene, your article is being flawed in some way. Do you think your perspective is unfairly skewed by your own addictive personality and childhood trauma?
Will you repeat that? I didn't hear it fully.
You indicate others / the financial industry in your article is being flawed in some way. Do you think your perspective is unfairly skewed by your own addictive personality and childhood trauma?
It's definitely influenced by it. So all I can say is the perspective that I've come to is definitely influenced by how I was raised and also the sort of, you know, process I went through to sort of see the world differently. I do want to say that, like, I don't want to be pointing my finger at other people individually. All I'm saying is that I do think that the culture is out of balance and needs some help on that front. And to your guys' question, like, absolutely. All I can do is see the world through the eyes that I've been kind of given to see.
Do you feel that the way you choose to live now in your nonprofit activities have filled the hole in your soul, for lack of a better term, or do you still struggle with your purpose and filling the hole in your life that was previously filled with drugs, money, women, etc.?
I don't think the nonprofit does it, although it helps. I'll tell you what, like, I do believe that every year I sort of fill up that hole more and more. And so now it's like a wound that has become a scar almost. So I don't want to say that I'm ever fixed, because it's never going to not be a scar. But it's definitely a lot better and a lot more less sensitive. And I will say the work with the nonprofit is like, let me even cut to before that. Like, you know, now I have this sort of like platform that, by the way, I wasn't expecting. You know, I sent in the article to Op-Ed at New York Times, and they miraculously printed it. And the reason I say that is because 6 months ago, I was just a guy running a tiny nonprofit with shopping a book around that nobody wanted to read. And I would literally stay at home at night sometimes. And like, I really had to work to say, like, the old voices in my head that say you're valuable because of what you've done or what you've produced or how famous you are would come out. And I would literally close my eyes at night and say, you know, I am enough and my life is enough. And the only thing that I really want to focus on is my wife and my soon to be daughter. And so I guess all that is to say, like, I'm trying to always remember that I am no more valuable now because I wrote a New York Times article or because I run this nonprofit than I was when I was on Wall Street or when I was after I left Wall Street and was sort of living an anonymous life. It's like, I really am trying to create this or hold to this belief system that says we are all valuable when we are born and it never changes no matter what we do.
Okay, I think that's it. Unless you have anything else to add, I'll post the link as well to your donate page and really encourage the guys to make the donation. Thank you for your time. And like the questions were coming in as we talked, and I was sourcing them the whole way through. So a lot of people were posting. One guy posted like 15 minutes in. I already love this guy. I'm sure everybody loved the call.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate all your kind of interest in setting this up, and I'm honored to have been a part of it. Thanks.